well as a writer of programs in the Biography series on A&E, the network that showed the recent Nero Wolfe series. He calls himself semi-retired, but is busy at work on a blog and weekly podcast devoted to classic mysteries, among them at least six Nero Wolfe novels. He has chosen one of the recurring characters from the books for his talk today, and he's going to disprove Jonathan's point, I think. Les? I heard somebody's phone go off, and it reminded me that mine was on.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everybody. I have notes because my memory's gone, and I hope you don't mind my working from them.
We don't mind if you have to speak up.
That should not be a problem. I have my voice projects reasonably well, I think. I want to spend just a moment or two talking about one of the recurring characters and essentially turning a spotlight on somebody who we all know, but who generally works unobtrusively and I think very effectively in the background. Now, obviously, Nero Wolfe's genius doesn't operate in a vacuum. I mean, Wolfe couldn't function properly as an investigator of crime without Archie Goodwin's arms and legs and his eyes and his ears and the occasional use of firearms. Wolfe also obviously requires the services of other detectives as well. They're employed as they're needed for ongoing investigations. Now, Wolfe's biographer, William S. Baringold, calls them the 35th Street Irregulars, an obvious reference to Baker Street Irregulars who were called upon by Sherlock Holmes. But Wolfe's irregulars are no amateurs. They are all licensed private investigators. And let's be honest, they vary pretty widely in their capabilities and their personalities, at least as those are reported to us by Archie. Fred Durkin, for example, appears to be better equipped with brawn than with brains. Ori Cather has some very serious character flaws, which make the basis for at least two of the novels. And Archie's prejudice against female detectives, and Jonathan, again, this goes back to what you were saying, I think it may make Archie less than fully reliable when he writes condescendingly about Dahl Bonner or Sally Holt. There's no shortage, however, of secondary investigators to be relied upon with varying degrees of confidence. But there is one among the irregulars who always rates Archie's highest praise and Wolfe's complete trust, and that's Saul Panzer, whom I refer to here as the leader of the pack of 35th Street irregulars. Now, it's important to note, at least from my standpoint, because as you probably have noticed, I am somewhat vertically challenged. Saul is quite short by comparison with Archie. Saul stands only 5'7", and when you look at him, as Baringold notes in his brief sketch of Saul, you can't see his face for his nose. His suit also generally needs pressing. He's not physically prepossessing, but there's no other detective among the irregulars who can claim Saul's overwhelming abilities. So when Nero Wolfe needs an operative to do something that he doesn't want Archie to know about for whatever reason, his first choice usually is Saul. In fact, Archie rarely writes about him without demonstrating both his affection and his respect. And I think the best description comes in Before Midnight. Here's what Archie says about him. Saul is not a natural for Mr. America. His nose is twice as big as he needs. He never looks as if he had just shaved. One shoulder is half an inch higher than the other, and they both slope, and his coat sleeves are too short. But if and when I find myself up a tree with a circle of man-eating tigers circling on the ground below and a squad of beavers starting to gnaw at the trunk of the tree, the sight of Saul approaching would be absolutely beautiful. I have never seen him fazed. Now, coming from Archie, that's pretty high praise. And of course, there are times, if I may say so, when it can be a good thing to be a relatively small person. Saul must have been very grateful for his size. In The Doorbell Rang, he had to be smuggled into the brownstone inside a packing crate, which was just 3 feet wide, 5 feet long, and 2 feet high. And believe me, I would have trouble getting through a space like that. Now, Saul, of course, is a freelancer now. But at one time, he did work as a member of Wolfe's regular staff. In Fertilance, Archie tells us that Saul, and Fred Durkin, for that matter, used to be on Wolfe's payroll, but when Wolfe had to cut back expenses because of the Depression, Archie says he and Saul got their weekly pay envelope sliced, but Fred's was stopped altogether. So it certainly sounds to me as if they had been staff employees at that point, just like Archie. But as a freelancer, Saul really prospers because he's able to charge a lot more than the going rate for a private eye. Baron Gould once again tracks Saul's reported daily rate as rising from $20 a day in 1945 to $80 a day in 1965, which in those days was not terrible money. And Saul does have talents that you might not expect to find in your average private investigator. Just as a for example, he apparently is a licensed private pilot. Again, in Fairlands, Archie complains that the man they've all been tailing plans to go up flying in a private plane. And he says the irregulars might as well stay home and play pinochle since they can't fly. Wolf's reply? Saul Panzer can. The clouds will have eyes. Unlike Wolf and Archie, now Saul is an East Sider. One of the best descriptions of his apartment in the novella 4th of July Picnic, we're told that Saul lived alone on the top floor of a remodeled house on 38th Street between Lexington and 3rd, which is just a couple of blocks down the street from where we are right now. The living quarters include a living room, bedroom, kitchen, and bath, and we presume that would be the location of the weekly card games, not the bath, the living room. The location of the weekly card games, initially pinochle and later poker, which Archie attended at Saul's place. Now that apartment's also used for Wolf's business. A couple of times it has provided sanctuary for Nero Wolf himself when he's been dodging the police or other law enforcement agencies. And in A Family Affair, it's a scene for a critical meeting between Archie and the irregulars as they try to figure out the best possible way to solve the central puzzle of that very unhappy mystery. And once again, it's Saul who plays the critical role in devising the ultimate solution to that problem, seeing even more clearly than Archie does what needs to be done to settle the affair. It's also worth noting that Wolf trusted Saul enough to have him hold down the office and live in the South Room while he and Archie travel overseas to the Black Mountain. When Saul is sent on an errand for Wolf, he almost always gets his man or woman. Not always, however. One of his rare failures happened at the death of a doxy, where he's dispatched to a nightclub to question singer Julie Jacquet about a murder victim named Isabel Kerr. No go. Poor Saul calls a brown phone, calls a brownstone rather, and tells Archie, "I'm licked. I've met my match. Julie Jacquet. I would give her a week's pay to know if you could have handled her." The trouble is partly that Nero Wolf's a celebrity, so she says, but mostly it's the orchids. If he will show her his orchids, she'll tell him all about Isabel Kerr. She won't tell me a damn thing. Nothing. On the other hand, that does give Wolf a chance to meet Julie Jacquet, who's one of the very few women in the corpus whose company Wolf really seems to enjoy. Now, perhaps Saul's most useful skill is his near-perfect memory for faces. In Too Many Cooks, for example, when he's brought into the room where all the suspects have been gathered, Archie observes, "After one look at Wolf, his sharp eyes darted around the rectangle of faces, and I knew that each of those faces had in that moment been registered in a portrait gallery where it would stay forever in place." Now it's that particular talent which moves Wolf to pay Saul what might have been the highest possible compliment that he could. And I think that Wolf really deserves to have the final word about Saul Panzer. And it comes in the novella Disguise for Murder. Now Saul has spent his afternoon checking members of the Manhattan Flower Club in and out of the brownstone. So when he has kept a list of the 219 guests who were admitted, so that when one of them is murdered, and in Wolf's office, no less, Inspector Kramer obviously wants to know who was there. He's very skeptical of Saul's ability to identify faces based solely on that one-time list. "Are you telling me," he said, "that you could fit that many names to that many faces after seeing them just once?" Saul's shoulders went slightly up and down. "There's more to people than faces. I might go wrong on a few, but not many. I was at that door to do a job, and I did it." "You should know by this time," Wolf rumbled, "that Mr. Panzer is an exceptional man." To which I would only add, he is indeed.
Les, thank you for that delightful look at Saul Panzer, one of our favorite recurring characters, male.
If you don't mind, give the text to Jean.
Oh, yes, for the Gazette, if you would, please. We're going to take a break now for coffee. and cookies.
There's homemade brownies and some cookies. And Ellen has cookies too.
Only brownies, my goodness.
No, Ellen brought cookies.
Okay, I'm moving. And let's, and swap and sell, which is, you buy it, it's not swap and sell. You buy, give real money.
Swap your money.
Sweatshirts or t-shirts, jeans.